Angela Singh, IPA Victoria board member and chair of the IPA Victoria Aboriginal Advisory Committee. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta woman with strong links to Wemba Wemba and Tunnerong. I'm also the regional director for Northwestern Victoria region at the Department of Education. I am very pleased to represent IPA Victoria and the Aboriginal Advisory Committee in this very special Public Sector Perspectives episode. Today, we will continue the powerful and reflective discussion at IPA Victoria's memorable International Women's Day Gala Dinner in March. Firstly, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands and waters that this podcast is being recorded on. For me, that's the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present. I extend that respect to my own community, all traditional owners of lands and waters, and First Nations people who may be listening to this recording. To celebrate International Women's Day, 1,300 people came together in person, not only to recognise women across the public purpose sector, but to hear from truly exceptional speakers about a critical topic, the opportunity of treaty, voice and truth. IPA Victoria led a momentous discussion with exceptional First Nations women who are at the forefront of driving Victoria's historic treaty and truth-telling process. This episode focuses on the unanswered questions from the audience of that night. And to begin, I'd like to take the opportunity to welcome back two of our guest speakers, Auntie Geraldine Atkinson, elected co-chair of the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria. Auntie Geraldine is a very proud Bannerang Wiradjuri woman and co-chair of the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria. She was elected to the Assembly in November 2019 as a candidate from North East Region. Welcome, Auntie Gerry.
Thank you very much, Ange, for inviting me to be a part of this podcast.
Thank you. We also have with us Chair or Auntie and Professor Eleanor Burke AM. Professor Eleanor Burke AM is a Wagaya Wemba Wemba Elder and is Chair of the Yurok Justice Commission. Welcome, Chair Burke.
Thank you, Angela.
I, for one, am very excited to continue this discussion. To begin with, I want to share a sentiment that we received on the night. An audience member wants to send love, thanks, and respect. I'm in awe of your tenacity and dignity. That's a lovely compliment to receive. But it also leads to a question about the personal impact on you both of being involved in the treaty and truth-telling process. And what we're really interested in is, how do you find the personal strength to stay involved in discussions and hear stories that are incredibly important but must often be deeply personal and traumatic? Auntie Geraldine, I might ask you to go first.
Well, Ange, thanks for the question. And I tell you what, you do need strength in being involved in Aboriginal affairs. You do need a lot of strength because there's so many barriers that we've had to face. But I just want to talk about my personal strength, because I carry the legacy of my elders and about creating a better future for our next generations, the generations to come. We've never ceded sovereignty over this country or waters. And I believe that what they've instilled is in me is to be staunch in standing up for our rights since, you know, we've had to endure through colonisation. I think the movement for justice, First Peoples and treaty is about carrying on their legacy. So it's about restoring the self-determination for our people. And that's, I think, is where, you know, what the things that we do matters, because it affects our culture, it affects our community, and it affects our country. And I think that's where I get my personal strength from. I can also say that on the whole, I'm really an optimistic person. I always believe about being optimistic, and I'm optimistic about what Treaty and Truth are going to do to enhance and improve the lives of our people here in Victoria.
Thanks, Auntie Jerry. Auntie Eleanor, how do you find the personal strength to stay involved in these discussions?
It's an interesting question, because everything you do contributes to something. And when we acknowledge our ancestors and elders, we're acknowledging the contribution they made in order for us to be in the space that we're in now. And I find that more meaningful in recent times. And Geraldine, I think you'll relate to this, how so much happened in the 70s in Victoria around land rights. And then we had, my family and I lived out of Victoria for almost 20 years and come back to Victoria at the end of last century and saw changes. And there were footprints on the ground for us in terms of a change about thinking about land justice especially. And then there were pieces of legislation that were unique to Victoria while the native title process was going on around Yorta Yorta, which was a failed decision, but it only made people more strong, I think, in some ways, even though it hurt everybody that was involved and was a terrible thing to watch from a distance. It made people stronger, and it also created a climate. And we were lucky that we had a political climate that was better than previously, where it was possible to have new legislation like the Aboriginal Heritage Act, for better or worse. It was still recognising people in First Nations spaces being on their land. Then we had the Traditional Owner Settlement Act that made another, that for me was another footprint. And then people, we got the Premier that we have now asking us what we wanted. And I was lucky enough to be at one of the meetings where he asked that question, and we couldn't answer it in that particular meeting. And after a number of meetings, we eventually landed on the concept of treaty and working with government. So there was plenty of work to do, and that environment happened because of our people that came before, who, you know, our family, our relatives, and we know, you know, all of them, whether they were in the land space or in other spaces, because it all mattered. Everything mattered because it seemed much more positive than what we had before. And obviously the native title decision against Yorta was a blow, but it didn't stop the fact that there are now four recognised native title groups in this state. However, every time something like that happens, because the way it has to happen in the contemporary legal framework always leaves people behind, and it's not enough time for the business to be done in a way that we might have done business previously. So that gives one strength, because you're not on your own. You've got so many people to look to and people that are around who are on the same pathway and understand the history and the fact that there are opportunities that we never had before, and that we in Victoria are actually showing other parts of Australia something that hasn't yet happened in those spaces.
And, you know, what struck me about both your answers was you've both spoken about the legacy and acknowledging our ancestors and elders, and that this space is not a blank canvas, that we are drawing on a long history of activism from the 70s and even back before that, and also that we have previous policies that have provided footprints into where we're going next. This next question further explores what was discussed on the night. For both of you, we'd like you to reflect on, what does treaty mean to you, and how will it change the work that you do? How does treaty and truth-telling impact you both every day. Auntie Geraldine?
I've always said, and we said from the beginning when we talked about the work that we were doing at First People's Assembly Victoria, when we first started with, we were tasked with setting in place the processes for the Victorian Aboriginal community to negotiate treaty. That's what we've done. And what we said, we identified at the very beginning that we couldn't have treaty in Victoria without having truth. And we realised that having, the truth being told, and I think the work that the Yuruk Justice Commission are doing is going to provide the evidence that we need and why we need treaties so badly to redress a whole range of those policies, Ange, that you mentioned. We can't rely on those same old practices that have been done in the past. We know they haven't worked. We know that government has been selective, and government really hasn't lifted our people up. They say they listen, but I don't think they really listen intently to what it is that we as a collective and with our communal culture are really saying. And so I really believe that we need to do this for ourselves, and we need to take our time with it. And that's the thing that I would give advice to the other states that are starting to work in this area as well, that it does take time, and you have to listen to community, and you have to talk to community, you have to talk to your mobs so that you get, it's what they want. It's not what we wanted, what we wanted as First People Assembly of Victoria, but it's what our community wants that we've been able to, to work towards. It took years in Victoria the work that Jill, the Commissioner for Treaty Advancement Commission, was critical to engage with community. She ensured that what she did, that she went out and listened and heard from community members about how they best wanted to be represented in the process. So treaty for me is about doing things differently, but it's also about honesty, and it's about telling the truth when things are difficult. We've had many discussions about how inappropriate it's been to use white or colonial structures to set up black institutions like First Peoples Assembly of Victoria. So we made sure that when we were working in the treaty process, that, we wouldn't be constrained through that colonial system. So, for example, we developed new processes for the treaty authority, which is underpinned by Aboriginal law. We had to have that included. That was really an important aspect of what we wanted to do. And what we wanted to do was make sure that, there was law and that people had the cultural authority to be able to talk about what it was that they needed within that treaty process and within that truth telling as well. So I think, that we've also been able to go worked outside of government. We looked at government processes, and this is in relation to traditional owner groups that haven't been able to get that that recognition from government. What we wanted to do was we introduced, a process we created that pathway, an additional pathway for those traditional owner groups to be able to come and sit at the assembly's table rather than having to rely and wait on existing government processes to enable them to do that. So those are the things that we were able to do as an Aboriginal organisation.
Annie Eleanor, Chair Burke, what does treaty and truth telling mean to you, and how does it impact you?
I won't say so much about treaty because Geraldine's laid out their position there, but what I do want to say is I thank First Peoples Assembly for putting the truth telling on the agenda, and it seemed to be necessary in order for other people to understand why treaty could happen. I think that's a basic question. However, for us, the truth telling is so important so that our people can put their voices on the record in a way that has not existed. We have lots of public records around settlement, around what happened when the English came here and made their laws, but we don't have our voices mixed in to this. There are a few inquiries that exist, but they're all one way, and they were all about the concept that we would die out. Well, we haven't died out. We're still here, and I think we're well represented, and the privilege that Yuruk has in a way is to be listening to the voices. And I have to say, as hard as it is sometimes to hear some of the stories about the trauma that started generations back, it's still important that those things go on the public record so that the rest of Victoria, other Victorians can learn why it is that we are calling for treaties. We don't want to have to educate them completely, but we do want them to understand that the history that they have was incomplete and that there is another history about the people and the place and our cultures and our identity that are closely connected to land and therefore potential for treaty making. And I think that's part of the truth that needs to be told about this state and indeed about the settlement of the whole country. And I think we're in a position where, well, thank heavens we don't have to deal with the kind of conversation that's happening at the moment at the national level. Because one thing I have to say, it's quite demeaning to hear it. It's an insult to our ancestors who went before and did so much in the best way they could for their times. And I feel it's an insult to the people that have been giving most of their lives who are involved at the moment at that level. And I just think things have got a little bit hysterical in some places to the extent of other issues being brought in around race and colour, which is just totally unacceptable now. And I think that makes the truth-telling all the more important, especially from our people.
And I think what resonated for me with both of your reflections on this question was that treaty is about truth, it's about honesty, and it's about trust. And the work of the Yuruk Justice Commission is going to provide that evidence. And as you said, Aunty Eleanor, put Aboriginal voices on the record. And the importance of us recognising that the history people have learnt to date has been incomplete. And so treaty and the work of the truth-telling process is going to be integral to correcting that history. And also, Auntie Geraldine, giving ourselves permission to work outside of government processes was another really clear factor that came out in that. So our next question is about how do you both advocate for inclusive cultural change? Auntie Geraldine, how do you advocate for inclusive cultural change?
You know, Ange, how I advocate is about talking to people. It's about building relationships, and it's about sitting down and having those yarns. And whether it be politicians, whether it be people in corporates, whether it be people in our community, our leaders. So it's about making sure that what we do is we talk and we have the yarns and we tell people exactly what it is that what we were doing, particularly with First Peoples Assembly of Victoria. You know, it's about letting people know how we make those decisions on those issues that affect our lives and our communities. So I talked about earlier about how it's about getting that cultural change. And I think it's really important about explaining to people exactly what it is by you know, when we advocate for that cultural change. It's about realising, you know, that when you look at how we've been doing things at First Peoples Assembly, we're democratically elected representative voice for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Victoria at the moment. What we do is about sitting, you know, making sure that the people that are represented and about talking and advocating on behalf of First Peoples Assembly are traditional owners of Victoria. And it's important about knowing, you know, sort of about their backgrounds, about them knowing where they come from, them realising what their legacy has been and the people that have gone before them also, that we've said that as well. So it's making sure that, you know, we get community members listening, and we want community members to realise that, you know, sort of at the moment we've got our election process in place. We want people to enrol and make sure they vote, because the more people that vote, enrol and vote, the more strength that gives us as an Aboriginal community to proceed with what it is that we want the change to be. That's really important. They have to be a part of that decision making, and it has to be inclusive and it has to be collective. You know, what we were able to do through all the work that we've done at First Peoples Assembly in ensuring that what we've got are the right processes in place for the negotiations of treaties, that what we did was we ensured that we, you know, we included the rights that are contained within the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And that was extremely important. That was a message that came through loud and clear from our members. And I think that, you know, we manifested UNDRIC's Articles 3, 4 and 5 about, you know, Indigenous people having the right to self-determination. By virtue of that right, they freely assume their political status and freely pursue their economic, social and cultural development, and that Indigenous people have the right to maintain and strengthen their distinct political, legal, economic, social and cultural institutions. And I think that that's what we've been able to produce in the framework that we've developed for treaty negotiations. When you look at you know, sort of how we built, you know, the Treaty Authority, how we initiated and produced the treaty negotiation framework, and then what we did with the self-determination fund, and is about ensuring that people had, that are going to have equal footing, that they'll equal footing, that there'll be funding available to traditional owner groups when it comes to negotiating treaty, that they'll have equal footing with government in relation to those negotiations. But they'll be able to buy in the expertise and all that, or, you know, sort of all the legal advice and everything else that's going to be required. So they're the things I think that what we've been able to achieve through this first iteration of First Peoples Assembly Victoria.
Artie Eleanor, Chair Burke, how do you advocate for inclusive cultural change?
Well, it's a bit hard to follow, Geraldine, because of how much activity there's been on the First Peoples Assembly's agenda. But I think a thought came to mind of the then President John Kennedy talking about things being of the people, for the people and by the people. And it kind of sums up a little bit of the way we think at Yuruk about hearing the voices of our people speak to the spaces that we are mandated to inquire into in a way that's never happened before. And this is, of course, a moment in history in Victoria, indeed for Australia, that this has happened for the first time. It's shameful that it's taken so long to happen, but it's the reason that we must not fail, because for people of Victoria, when we've heard our people's voices, we're able to share that so that there is this greater understanding about the history and about the places that we all live and share together, and what they missed out on by not understanding our aspects of our culture. And the final aspect of that is, I guess, the by the people, these things lead to what we like to call in shorthand truth, understanding, transformation. The truth enables greater understanding from the whole of the population. The transformation is about the changes that need to be made. And Geraldine's outlined what the assemblies had to do to enable a treaty process just to be in place. Well, we want the systems around us to be transformed in a way that they are more supportive and more in line with our culture than they have been in the past, because the reality is we've been stuck with the silos that were given when the very first pieces of legislation around protection and removal were implemented.
And I think what really came across to me was you both talked about inclusive cultural change was about investing in relationships, investing in understandings to bring about that transformational change, and bringing people with us on the journey and that inclusive decision making, as well as drawing on international key commitments as well to help further our strong arguments. Aunty Eleanor, Chair Burke, I'm going to go to you with this next question. There is a lot of goodwill across the community in regards to Aboriginal affairs, but what advice would you give to non-First Nations colleagues on how to best support their First Nations colleagues?
To listen and learn. Our education system has let us down in, I think, in recent times, and I'm not on top of what's happening these days, Angela, but I can remember a period of time in the 80s where there was great enthusiasm about some aspects of Aboriginal studies and having to have people, non-Aboriginal people, trained to teach Aboriginal people. Well, it was kind of the wrong way around when you think about it. It should have been the embracing of Aboriginal people into those professions, into being teaching and training. But I think this is one of the difficulties that makes it so hard for us now, because so much time's passed, and what we're aspiring for, which we think should have been the norm, we're talking about 200 years of settlement in this place that we call Australia. That's not only damaged our culture, it's damaged our land, it's damaged our environment, and it's so hard to bear sometimes. So everybody loses if we're not doing well, to be honest.
Auntie Geraldine, what advice would you give to non-First Nations colleagues about how to best support First Nations colleagues?
My advice is for non-First Nations colleagues to amplify the voice of their Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander colleagues and friends. That's really important. We need support. We need respect. We deserve to be supported, and we deserve to be respected. As Aunt said, ours is the oldest living culture on earth, but we do need allies, because Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are only about 3% of the population. When you think about that other 97% out there, that we need their support. We need them to know about us and our culture. So they have a critical role. And as Aunt said, it's about them learning themselves. So they've got a critical role to play in the processes that we put in here in Victoria for treaty making. We want allies. They vote in governments, and government policies have historically marginalised and discriminated against us. So I want to call on those allies who are listening to really educate themselves, and so that they can do their own research and forge their own relationships. So they need to do their own hard work. We can't do it for them. They have to do it. And what I want to talk about is just say that later this year, when people are asked to vote in the voice to Parliament for the referendum, I want to make sure that what they have done also is their own homework, and that they'll know when and they'll feel confident about when they step into that ballot box that they'll be making the right decision. So that's what I think that we need that support, and we need that support coming from non-First Peoples.
And those opening words of Auntie Eleanor, listen, listen and learn. Auntie Geraldine, amplifying the voices of Aboriginal people and doing the work. Great, thank you. There's a lot of talk about barriers when it comes to Aboriginal affairs, and this next question is really getting your thoughts about reflecting on some of the barriers you've experienced, both as women and as a First Nations people, and how did you overcome those barriers? So, Auntie Eleanor, I might go to you first.
It's a bit of a hard one because I stepped into Aboriginal affairs spaces, and I'm thinking like the old league, you know, we're in a friendly space where people all aspired to similar things. It's when we got away from that space and went into, say, a government department where you feel the difference, where people are not even in that headspace at all, that it became difficult. And I might say there were some difficulties in terms of the fact that early in my time, most of the people that were dealing with in government were all white men in the main, which is another challenge because there was a very narrow view about Aboriginal affairs from some of those people. So we had to work smart, but I think two things for me were, you know, strength from within my own family, from other strong women mainly, and the family network, but also from the people that I met once I stepped into Aboriginal affairs, as I referenced to the Aboriginal Advancement League, you know, people that were been at the forefront for all that time, and you could see that there was the need for younger people to step up, be part of the work. And I think it seems to be a generational thing that's come about from in most of our families. If we look into our families, we see this where people have done different things. Geraldine, your family, you know, people that have gone from us now made great contributions in my own family, some similar. My grandmother was a very, very strong Aboriginal woman who had a big influence on our family overall, and strong aunties in the family. So we draw strength there. But I agree with Geraldine about the allies. You know, we need allies, and we have always had allies, and we need to remember from time to time to acknowledge that. And, you know, as far back as the 1930s, referencing the Aborigines Advancement League, or not the the old Aborigines, Australian Aborigines League, William Cooper's days, where it had 33 branches in the state of Victoria, and mostly non-Aboriginal people. They're supporting some Aboriginal people in disparate places, which I think is a wonderful example then. And it's the sort of thing we need now, or they need at the national level to straighten up some of those people that are scaremongering around skin colour and race.
Auntie Geraldine, what were some of the barriers you've experienced as a woman, but also as a First Nations person, and how did you overcome them?
Well, I'm going to tell you a story. I grew up in southern New South Wales with a very big family, so lots of brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews that were called brothers and sisters. And I know they faced, and we all did, we, as family members, face barriers all of those early years in our lives. And the barriers and the challenges and the trauma, and, you know, sort of it's about even thinking back and thinking about the trauma that we endured as well. They were different for a lot of the young men in my family to what, you know, was for the women compared to our lives. We lost, you know, young men in our family very early on. So that was a lot of trauma. But one of the things my mother instilled in me and my siblings was an intensive drive and this appreciation for education. Because growing up at the time, on the missions, and I went to the mission school at Kamaragunja, and then I lived on Rumbalara, which was like a reserve. So I know when Mum lived, you know, thinking about her history and what she came through, and now the story she told about living on Kamaragunja, and about she could only go to grade three. And then they had to, you know, they weren't allowed in school, and they were really definitely were not allowed to speak their language. So, you know, languages were lost, and she realised that, and she was terrified if people would speak language. That's the story she would tell us. So that would be her trauma that was passed on to us as trauma about those things. So she wanted to make sure that, you know, what we did was that we would, you know, that we were proficient in English and that we could read and that we could write, because she couldn't read. My father taught her to read when they were married. So they're the things that she wanted. So, you know, when I think about over the years and my journey, Eleanor, through the education process that, you know, I've been involved in with my family, I saw what was happening in our communities in, you know, sort of up there in Shepparton, and about how kids were leaving school at the end of year nine. And no, you know, no academic skills. And it was really, depressing. So the work that I did, and I wanted to do that work within the education system. And what I wanted to do, you know, me and my family tried different things. And then what we decided, well, we have to start at the very beginning. And starting at the very beginning was that we needed to start in the early years. So what we did was we started a childcare centre and a kindergarten and a school within a school. So they were the three things that we worked really hard on doing and thinking about how we would get our kids to complete their education. But we faced barriers. We not only faced barriers, you know, the teachers, because we had a school within a school, the teachers were really racist, and they were racist to our kids. And, you know, they would comment on, you know, everything. And when I worked in TAFE and we were working with kids that had left school and didn't have schools, and teachers would say, you know, they were privileged. And teachers would say when we had Marnika that our kids were privileged. Well, that they weren't privileged. That was not privilege. We had to provide those additional supports because they weren't we were not a privileged people. We did not have those same privileges that, you know, those non-Aboriginal kids had, and nor did our kids in our community. So, I know that it was really important that what we had to do, but we started with that early childhood centre. So we were able to combine our kindergarten and our childcare centre, and ended up getting funding to do that. So what I did was I, with, you know, everyone's permission, call that place Lullis after my mother, because that was her thing about how she had looked after so many children, her 14 of us, then her grandchildren, and then their nieces and nephews as well. So it was about, you know, showing that what she had done, well, we were carrying on and showing that we could look after those children as well. And so I just felt that it was, you know, what we needed to do was make sure that it was looking at the barriers that we faced, that I faced in my childhood, in my teenage years, that I think you talked earlier about giving people strength, Ange, and what it did for you. So it did give us the strength, and it did give us, you know, the ideas about being able to think about how we can change and make it better for those other generations coming behind us. And I think that that was really important. And, you know, they face that racism. I think they still face that racism today in the education system, and it's something that we have to eradicate, that needs to be, so that, you know, it doesn't continue on. So it's about making sure about, you know, sort of when we look at the barriers that we face as women. And I know, I can tell you, Ange, I know that men are treated differently to women. Being a woman, I know. There are, you know, it's just a fact. It's a fact that, you know, sort of they get listened to more than what women get listened to. And what we need to do is and I talked about amplifying our voices. Well, I think that we need to really make sure that we amplify our voices as women and make sure that to let people know that we are women of strength and that we were strong and we're going to continue to fight for what we want, for the better outcomes, for the better impacts on our children, our grandchildren and their children.
I think both of you talked about a key to overcoming barriers is drawing on the strengths from within our families, and particularly the women in our families who we've all been privileged to have such deadly strong women. I think learning from the people that we're working with, Aunty Eleanor, including people from our own communities, but also from our allies as well. And Aunty Geraldine, education being a key foundational pillar to overcoming trauma and addressing barriers. And I think both of you have been such shining lights in elevating the importance of education across our communities. So I wanted to slip in a thank you for that as well. There was a lot of interest on the night from the audience about your thoughts on the voice to Parliament and the challenge to make sure that this conversation about the voice is not a divisive one in our country. What's your thinking about the voice and ensuring that this is a conversation that brings us together as opposed to dividing us? Aunty Eleanor, I might go first to you.
Again, it's about people not understanding what happened in the beginning. The fact that we were not included in the Australian Constitution, and that exclusion lasted 67 years into last century, is mind-boggling. The fact that people believed in a law of terra nullius, that this was an empty land and there were no people, or that black people weren't regarded the same as white people, I mean, it is mind-boggling to me to think that people could expect to live in perpetuity on land that was stolen in those beliefs. And I find it very difficult to hear the conversations now that are going on, with people becoming more and more strident against the position of voice. So I'm glad we're not in that space, but I hope that in Victoria that we can contribute in a way that's constructive and shows the way. And don't forget that, you know, Queensland, South Australia, Northern Territory are all looking at treaty making. They're keeping an eye on us here in Victoria, Geraldine, we know, don't we? And watching the truth telling and thinking about how they best do things in relation to their spaces. We just hope that, again, that the common sense will prevail and that truth and understanding will come to the fore, because it's quite worrisome that the way the conversation's gone at the national level around the voice. And there's no question that it's being used as a political football by some people for their own purposes. You know, commentators who've never spoken the word Aboriginal now talking about us in a way that's never happened before from certain media outlets. I find it distressing, really. Quite distressing, but I do find that I'm distressed for our ancestors because of what I said earlier about the way people wanted to make change, wanted to be understood, and here we are back in this space just around this concept of the one word, voice, which seems to mean so many different things to so many people.
Thank you, Aunt. Auntie Geraldine, what are your thoughts about the voice to Parliament and the challenge to make sure this is not a divisive conversation.
I absolutely agree with the voice. I agree. What I really want to see is a successful referendum. A resounding yes is what I want to see, because I think the voices just say very important. I think, you know, when you look at what we've done here in Victoria, it's we've been able to use our voice to get, you know, sort of through the things that we wanted, to be able to build relationships with government, to be able to talk to government about and negotiate with government what it was we wanted for treaty in Victoria. So that was our voice. And what we thought, what we need here is that we have to, you know, support and encourage the voice at a national level. Because, you know, as I said, we've laid the foundations for our treaty making. We consulted, we engaged with community far and wide, and to, you know, to design all those elements I talked about. But we also need to be able to ensure that what we're doing is on, you know, sort of that we are talking to people, that we are ensuring that it's not just our mobs, but all Victorians, all Australians, as many as we can talk to say that this is why we need a voice, you know, that we want to make sure that it benefits all those other states and territories. Because of what we've been able to achieve in Victoria, I think it's a really good example. And I hope, you know, sort of as Eleanor said, that the other states are looking at us and doing, you know, sort of those things as well. I was really, you know, sort of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, it really pulled at my heartstrings. And when they talked about those three pillars that they wanted was voice, treaty and truth. And it's so much that we were wanting here in Victoria, because all three are needed. And what we need to do is make sure that we get the support from those allies that we talked about. We get the message out to allies and say, it's really important, because we're going to, you know, as a collective at both local levels, regional levels, statewide levels and national levels, we all, in all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, will have a say in what the voice looks like. And it's, as I said earlier, I'm optimistic. I'm an optimistic person. And I have faith in the younger generation, in our nation. That's all Australians. And I believe that it will happen. I, you know, sort of things that there are politicians that are saying and are being divisive, that, you know, I think those people, and a lot of, you know, they've got influence on parents and grandparents, and they can read through, you know, sort of, I was going to say a swear word there, but I better not. They can read through the crap and come themselves to an understanding of exactly why it is needed. So I think that, you know, that's why I am optimistic. I watched the media interview with the ex-Liberal politician who's running around Australia amplifying and advocating for the Yes campaign, and it was really heartwarming. It's to just hear what he had to say, and it was heartwarming because, you know what he said? He said he was influenced by his children. His under 30 children influenced him to do it and said, do this, Dad, you could do it. And that's what gives me hope, you know, that we are able to be, that it is going to change. And you know, I'm trying to think of the word to say, but, you know, sort of the people out there, that I think it'll be the people that make the decisions, not the politicians.
Thank you. Such great insights from both of you about this really important topic. And I think constructive, respectful conversations is key to everything. This next question is a little bit more personal. And it's, as First Nations female leaders, what is one piece of leadership advice that you've received that made a difference to you, you feel comfortable in sharing with us. So one piece of leadership advice that made a difference to you that you'd like to share. Annie Eleanor?
Oh, gosh, that's a really hard question. I'll just relate it to the work at the moment. One of the things I've found that's really important that we have to have trust and respect, really, between each other. And this is for our people, ourselves, in order to be able to stand up strong and talk to other people too. And I think it's challenged a lot in these times when we've got the kind of dialogue going on at the national level. And I would just add as a comment to what we were saying before that we do need this exercise to succeed in the way Geraldine's describing, putting faith in the younger people, the way we need it to succeed in order for this country to be complete. Otherwise, we'll just be sort of broken in a way if part of the country's, the whole of Australia doesn't come to the party on this. We will not be complete. What's the point of belonging to a federated commonwealth of countries if we're not complete in our own space on our countries? And I do think that's one of the things I hope people can come and understand. But I can't express anything better than what Geraldine was saying about young people as well. I think that's really important, and that there is a truth in that as well, because Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, there's a lot more dialogue and communications across the board because of the way we communicate now. So people are quite exposed to, I think, some broader views, sometimes not for the best, but I think for the good things, there's the opportunity there as well. So I just hope common sense does prevail.
Thank you, Aunt. Auntie Geraldine, what's a piece of leadership advice that you've received that made a difference to you?
I think it was when I was leaving school, sort of rearing a family, and I've had children very early. I was a baby myself, having babies. But what happened was I got a job as a teacher aide, and it was my brother Alf Bamblett, and he said to me, he said, "I want you to do something. I want you to get off your mum, get out there, and work for your community." So that was a piece of advice that I've never ever forgotten. And in all that I do, one of the things, Ange, about it, and it's about leadership, but it was being guided by really strong people, that had the right beliefs, that wanted to do and needed to do the right thing by community, that they didn't end up wealthy or rich or anything out of it all. They worked really hard, and they worked for Aboriginal organisations, and they put their all into it to make sure. And I think that one of the things about that is that what they did, they inspired my journey, okay, to leadership. And it was following by example. It was following their examples and seeing what they did, what selfless work that they did, in working for, both the local, state and national levels. It was selfless. And that and I think it was just following that and being inspired by that and wanting to do what they did. Was the things about, when you talk about how you wanted to be, about having a leadership journey. And I think it is like being, led by example, because I was led by people like Eleanor as well. It wasn't just my own family, but other strong women that I'd had. I was just so enriched and had, sort of just the great fortune to have participated in meetings with them, and just to listen and to watch exactly what they did. And that was, I think, was what was what inspired me so much, because I was carted around to a lot of conferences and meetings, I can tell you, Ange.
Yes, definitely. And a lot of, you know, as we're growing up, a lot of conversations, having the privilege to hear conversations at kitchen tables. Yes, that's that gentle mentoring, gentle nurturing. Yes. So that advice is really, really important. I think, Aunty Eleanor, you talked about the advice you shared was trust and respect and stand up strong. And Aunty Geraldine, you talked about the advice of work for your community and be guided by your community. Real gems for all of us to take on as we go forward. I was personally interested in asking you this question. And it was, who has inspired you in your leadership journey and why? So, Aunty Eleanor, who's inspired you in your leadership journey and why?
Gosh, how long have you got? Geraldine just referenced mentors, and, you know, there are so many, and at the time you don't think in that way, of course, but you're sitting at the feet of people who've already had a lived experience when you go into, for example, going into the old league, and people were very inspirational and certainly left a legacy for us to continue, and within their own families they have that great legacy. There's so many people to name, it's very hard. Geraldine, you talked about Alf, and I think about Mary often because of, you know, the work we did together. There's so many people that were touched through opportunities that came to us, and we took those opportunities. And when you look back, you think, oh, gosh, that person was my mentor. And, you know, Auntie Geraldine Briggs, Merle Jacquemos, you know, dearest friend, Elizabeth Hoffman, and I mentioned Mary. I mean, we can go on and on and on about people. It becomes quite personal and emotional, but you don't know about it at the time. Your family die, you know, die, called you by your mum's name. Because I'm thinking of but you know what I mean. It becomes emotional and you think about it, and it's just... it just blossoms because there's so many people that are in our orbit through this work that we've embarked on. And hopefully that's part of a legacy that will continue among our family and our people forever. And we will succeed, hopefully.
Definitely. Auntie Geraldine, would you like to share something about someone who's inspired you on your leadership journey and why?
I have to say that it was Mary Atkinson, that she really did inspire me. She, you know, as I said, she took me to so many meetings. She took me to meet politicians, she, you know, so wherever she went. And she inspired me on that journey. But I also had people like Aunty Melva Johnson. I was just blessed to sit at a table with Aunty Melba and listen to her stories and how hard she worked. I'd witnessed how hard her and Aunty Val had worked in Echuca and how they built that community. I saw that hard work. They did that, those two very strong women. And then I saw what Mary had done in our community and the work that she'd done. And to sit at the table with the likes of, like, Aunty Melva, Mary, and Aunty Laura Bell. And you know what, Ange? They were gentle women. Mm. They didn't bang the tables. They didn't jump up and down and rant and rave and, you know, talk to politicians like they were, you know, sort of. They had respect for people. They had respect for all people. And they were so gentle in how they negotiated. And I think that's one of the things I was asked, you know, sort of about why is my leadership style, say, different than somebody else's? And I said, I had been privileged to sit, you know, under people like Eleanor and Mary and Auntie Melva and Auntie Laura. And I'd seen them negotiate. And there are others too, Eleanor, at the national level as well.
Yes.
But it was, you mentioned privilege before, and I think that I had been privileged to be able to and be nurtured and coached by people like that.
This is our last question, and it's about what's your advice for young women who are looking to make their mark in public or public service life, or in the community for that matter? What's your advice to young women?
That's really what I want to do is ensuring, and I do that with my nieces. Now, I tell them, and I want to tell them, you know, that this, what I just spoke to you earlier about how you handle yourself, how you speak to people, how you build relationships, and ensuring that you do build good relationships, that's what I want to tell them, that you have respect for people and that, you know, you honour your elders and you honour those that are older than you and you listen to their advice, and that what you need to do on your journey is you need to bring people along with you. You don't antagonise people. You don't, because that's not the way to get people and that's not how you build relationships. So it's about building relationships, and it's bringing people along, you know, to the table so that they can be heard just as much as you want to tell, or, you know, or you want to voice your opinion, that you have to listen to others as well. And one of the things I'd also say to them, don't ever underestimate the power of hard work, because I can tell you it's been hard work, Ange. So it's about, you know, putting in the effort, and it's about making sure that you had work hard to achieve the outcomes that we need to, you know, to change things in our Aboriginal communities for our Aboriginal young people. And there's so much work that has to be done, and they have to be. And I want to make sure that we empower them to do it, but do it, you know, in a way that is respectful and is respectful during negotiations as well.
Auntie Eleanor, what's your advice for young women looking to make their mark?
Well, I would say that we are seeing emerging young people already in spaces. I'm ashamed to say, yet we haven't at Yuruk spoken to the young cohort that we will speak to before we've finished, because we're very mindful that's a space we want to hear from in terms of what aspirations are there. But my advice to people is do the very, very best you can in that respectful way that the very best you can do, but do it in a way that you bring people along with you. We want people to be with us, not against us. So it's always that aspect of making sure that there's trust and respect. And our custom of honouring and remembering elders past and present is really important. I'm not so mad about using that emerging word in that acknowledgement, because I like the idea that the young people are coming behind in the way that we're just trying to speak to now, and they will help shape that in the future. But being a great grandmother, you know, I see my daughters as grandmothers doing what I was doing at that same age, worried about cultural connections, whether they see me enough as the grandmother, you know. they're saying, you know, while you're at Yuruk, we've lost, my daughters say, have lost our mother, you know, which I find a bit embarrassing. But this is what they say, Geraldine, and you know, you said it's hard work. It is hard work, because we have put in long hours and we continue to put ourselves in that space for some reason, because we believe in what we're doing, and we want others to share that belief and want them to understand why we believe in the way that we do.
Yes, and you've both talked about bringing people along with you, the importance of showing respect, building relationships, building trust, and the importance of honouring people's contributions. And I think with that comes gratitude as well, showing gratitude. But we've come to the end of this podcast, and I wanted to say a huge thank you, Auntie Geraldine, and Chair Auntie Eleanor Burke, for once again taking the time to share your personal thoughts and reflections. We've talked a lot about privilege, but it has been an absolute privilege sharing time with you today to explore these topics in depth and to say thank you for being so generous with your time. I could sit here for many, many more hours and listen to you and listen to your reflections, listen to your stories, but the time has gone quickly. And on behalf of IPA Victoria and the IPA Aboriginal Advisory Committee, I wanted to say a very heartfelt thank you.
Thanks very much for having us, Ange.
Yes,
I could listen to Eleanor all day too.
Well, I just want to say a big thank you to you, Angela, because the way you are able to draw things together is really uplifting. You make me sound better than I think I sounded anyway, but you keep things drawn together and you do it so well that I thank you very much for that. I heard you on the night of the big event where you did exactly the same thing. So I'm very, very grateful for your contribution now and then, and what you've done and your journey as well. So thank you.
Yes, thank you. And I echo exactly what Eleanor said. So you just make it feel like it's just a yarn and comfortable and everything else. So it's great.
Yes. Thank you, ladies. This podcast follows the conversation at IPA Victoria's International Women's Day Gala Dinner event. IPA Victoria will continue to foster discussion about treaty, truth and voice in a variety of meaningful ways in the coming months. You can stay in touch with what we do by following us on LinkedIn at IPAA Victoria or on Twitter at IPAAVIC. This program is produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. I'm Angela Singh, and thank you for listening.